Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. With each day, more of the details of loss emerge from the flooded communities of eastern Kentucky. We have several accounts to share with you. First, WEKU's Samantha Morrill looks into efforts to recover an important collection of the region's history.
Walking Main Street in Hindman, the devastation of the flooding is clear to see. The contents of buildings spilling from the front porch into the yard, a house with a roof caved in the middle and sagging nearly to the ground, and inches of packed dry mud coats the ground in places. The road is still tinged a faint orange color, and every truck and car that passes by kicks up a cloud of dust that seems to seek out your eyes and nose. Heading up to the Hindman Settlement School, though, it actually looks okay from the outside. But the proximity of the creek below tells you that can't be the case. Hindman faculty, who saw the water crest over the bridge on the property, say their best guess is the water in the creek was 20 feet higher than normal.
That's what we estimated. It's about 11 and a half feet from the bridge to the water now, and the bridge is about 8 feet.
That's Melissa Helton. She gave me a tour of the damaged buildings.
I am community programs manager. Usually. I've become a volunteer coordinator and an emergency archive rescuer, but usually community programs manager.
Helton says she was home in Leslie County when the floodwaters swelled toward the school's buildings. In the now gutted first floor of the Mike Mullen Center that housed their archive and offices, surrounded by whirring fans and dehumidifiers, she says it's lucky she was, because those who were still on campus didn't have cell service or a way to communicate with each other.
And I was able to relay information between the different places in campus, and I was able to help organize rides for the writers home whose cars had swept away, things like that.
Back outside, Helton says the writers, 60 of them, were on campus for the 45th anniversary of the Appalachian Writers Workshop. Looking toward the creek, now gently flowing, Helton says the day after the flood, when everyone on campus was safe, Hindman Settlement School opened its doors to the community.
Will Anderson, our director, immediately said, if any community member needs a bed, we don't have any running water to wash the sheets for you, but you can come in and stay. And we immediately got people on campus.
Almost a month later, there were still nearly a dozen community members staying in the rooms on campus while they try to secure permanent housing. Helton said in addition to helping the people, they also had to figure out how to deal with the archive. The school was founded in 1902, and the collection in the Mike Mullen Center held the history of the school and the surrounding area. Executive Director Will Anderson told his staff to see what they could do.
And I usually do creative writing and gardening programming in the high school, so I know nothing about archives. I know I'm still learning about Appalachian history, but it was one of those things where time was of the essence. So,
Helton says the floodwater had risen 52 inches up the walls of the archive.
95% of it was wet, about 70% of it covered in mud.
Luckily, an old friend of Helton's now works at the National Archives in D.C. She says she immediately reached out.
And I was like, oh my gosh, help me know what to do until somebody who knows more gets here. And, you know, she explained the time crunch that, you know, there's kind of that window, the 72 hours when things start to mold and irreparable damage happens. And so she was able to give me enough guidance until we sent out the SOS on social media saying, oh my gosh, somebody come down here, help us out.
Helton says the biggest piece of advice she got was to freeze everything she could.
That's what everybody told me. They said putting it in a freezer puts pause on the mold, on the inks running.
Helton shows me to a wall lined with three huge deep freezers, all filled to the brim with brown and white paper packages, some of them tightly wrapped with plastic grocery bags.
Yeah, so some of these, especially the first editions, were the things that we prioritized or things that were signed.
Everything is labeled. A manila folder reads documents, wet and dirty. A book-shaped package is marked Song Ballads and Other Songs of the Pine Mountain. It's dated and says signed by Catherine Pettit. Another, lumpier package is labeled American Flag, somewhat dirty. Helton reaches for a plastic bag.
Some of these are papers. Some of these are photographs. And some of these, I don't even know what they are. And that's been one of the challenges. I don't have the Appalachian Studies background to know, is this just a corn husk doll that was in here for decoration, or is this really important?
Helton explained that the community is a living part of the archive, and they'll be instrumental in putting the historical collection back in order.
Because so much of our history is held in the collective memory of the community. So many times people have come through here in the past 3 weeks and seen a photograph, and they're like, oh, I remember this. I was there. Or, oh, that's my uncle. And so I think that's going to be a place in the future that we're going to need a lot of help from the community identifying these things.
Hindman Settlement School Executive Director Will Anderson says they'll also need an archivist to help properly catalog and store all of the items in the archive. But he says it's going to be a difficult position to fill.
It's unlikely that we'll find somebody with the experience and the skill set locally, but it would be debatable that someone would want to, you know, move here, you know, for what could be a temporary position or a part-time position.
Anderson says they're hoping for grant funding to support the position, but they may have to pay out of the school's own coffers. And Anderson says this has already been an expensive cleanup process.
We spent approaching $250,000 just in cleaning out all the mud and taking down the sheetrock that's wet and drying the buildings out. So just doing that was very expensive and doesn't even take into account the contents of the buildings.
Anderson adds that getting the property back to pre-flood condition could cost another $700,000 or $800,000. One thing is not going to return to pre-flood condition, though. Anderson says the archive will not go back to the Mike Mullen Center.
We want to find a different location for those archives. They were on the ground floor of a building that's never flooded before. And we're a 120-year-old organization, and the level of water is beyond what anyone could have imagined. We thought those records were safe, but obviously they weren't. And so the plan is to fundraise to build a structure that's up the hill.
The executive director says it will take a lot of effort to finally see a new building to house the archive on the school's campus. He says the process will likely take more than 2 years. Back at the Hindman Settlement School, Melissa Helton was pointing out the area of land farther up the hill that's a potential building site. She echoed a common refrain among the volunteers and staff.
It is such a cliche, and everybody has said it, but it is absolutely true that the sprinting part of this, the emergency sprinting part, is over, and now it's a long haul marathon.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Samantha Morrill.
Reggie Van Stockham, lawyer, teacher, biologist, writer, and guitarist, devotes much of his free time traveling the back roads of Kentucky, keeping a journey log and photographing as he goes. Reggie, you put a lot of mileage on that blue six-cylinder Ford Fusion of yours, and you've been writing a journey log about communities and places along the Kentucky River. After the July 28 flood, you went back and traveled the same routes that you had chronicled before to witness and write about the devastation and the experiences of people who survived it. It's a vivid account, and listeners, you can find a link on the homepage of our site, esweku.org. For this segment, we're picking up where Samantha Morrill left off, in Hindman and the aptly named Troublesome Creek. Tell us about your observations in Hindman.
Well, Troublesome Creek ought to be called the Troublesome River. Mm-hmm. If you take a look at your terrain view in the map app on your smartphone, you can take a bird's eye view and then hone right in on how deeply in the mountains Hindman is and how far Troublesome Creek extends up in these crenulated mountains of eastern Kentucky. Right at Hindman, you have a left fork and a right fork, and they go for some distance. And when I went to Hindman, as I often do, I look for those junctions of creeks that come together to form that small, flat land upon which you might build a village, a home, or even a county seat. And that's what happened here. And it is a gorgeous spot in eastern Kentucky. And there's a bridge on the on the side behind the downtown, an old bridge that you can stand on, and you can look and see those two creeks, the Right Fork and the Left Fork, come together and form Troublesome Creek. It's very placid. It's very beautiful with the hills in the background. But on the night of the 27th of July, Wednesday night, down those creeks came a wall of water as strong as iron, as angry as a monster, and with the face of the apocalyptic horseman. And they came and slammed into each other and then slammed into Hindman. And what was the main street of Hindman headed south along Troublesome Creek was a new lake, except a lake with rabid water, water that was surging forward from all of the rain that had hit all of the land surfaces on that left and right fork. And as it came down, it had power that you just don't attribute to water until you're in it. And then you recognize that's enough power to snap you in two. And it came into the downtown area, and it smashed into the windows of the Appalachian Artisan Center, the studios. And it just reached in, grabbed everything on that first floor, and swept it out in a violent fashion to thrust it down on Troublesome Creek to add to the troubles that were going to be moving down that creek.
Mm-hmm. And as you traveled down creek, you came upon some communities we don't always hear about that had been really hit hard. Can you recall a couple of those?
Well, certainly. And when you're in Hindman and you move down Troublesome Creek, Troublesome Creek is really itself a long community, and it's fairly tight. And the impact of those waters was just terrifying and awful. Homes, not just mobile homes, homes that were constructed, all of them lifted up off of their mountings and moved down a stream to be smashed into each other and smashed into trees. When I came out of Troublesome Creek, I popped over to Hazard, and of course they had lots of flood damage in Hazard, but much of Hazard is a hill community, a knob community, almost like Cincinnati. So I went down to Blackie. Blackie had suffered damage down in the lower areas of that circular main street it has, that very cute area. Blackie's one of the secrets of eastern Kentucky and a lovely place to visit. And I followed the North Fork of the Kentucky River down, 588, I think it's called, down to come into Whitesburg by the side. And, you know, there was a lot of damage. Interestingly enough, the waters would peel the asphalt off. Some places it would just break it into chunks. In other places, it would peel it like it was a peanut butter sandwich.
Wow.
Very, very strange when you saw it.
Talking about a lot of force there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, when we look at those aerial photos that we've seen in the papers, we've seen on television and whatnot, the floodwater looks placid, looks, you know, very calm. But that really is deceptive, isn't it? You don't see the terror that's going on down there.
No, you're right. And as we know from the experience in Whitesburg, you don't hear the emergency sirens. Uh-huh. And when you see it from an aerial view, as we did the first couple of days in the newspapers, we're aghast and we're troubled. But, you know, a couple of days later, you know, it looks like a bathtub. Let's move on to something else. Well, that was just one aspect of what looked like a lake that was actually a river. And underneath that surface, you have water that is not only soaking and deteriorating everything that it's coming in contact with, but it is surging forward, surging in a way that if you were to step into it, you would be swept off your feet and carried down. You know, we think that the damage is because of the lake water, when in fact, it's this moving, violent surge of water that will carry you away from your ability to control your actions. And it's a very short period of time until you're caught up in debris and smashed up like that debris.
We've heard a lot in recent days about the Appalachian community of southeastern Kentucky really coming together. Those of us who know the region are not surprised at all to hear that. Can you give us some examples of that kind of community and sense of neighborliness?
It's stunning. There was a terrible loss of life. I think currently somewhere around 40. Mm-hmm. But when you drive through these areas and you see the extent of the damage, not those placid aerial lake photos, but the mobile homes that are wrapped around trees, cars that are on end, There's one place in Millstone where there is a pontoon boat that has been lifted up, sit on top of a car, which itself is on a trailer. When you see all of that power, it is remarkable, miraculous even, that the death toll was less than it was. And I think a lot of that has to do with the resilience of the people, the ability of the people in that part of Kentucky to immediately come together to serve each other. So in May King, for example, out in kayaks, John boats, you know, people pulling people off of roofs. An example that I'll even say is a famous example now is at McRoberts, up Wright Fort, right above Fleming Neon. And Neon just got clobbered from water coming down from McRoberts. Well, the lower end of McRoberts had a fine big old bridge leading into town. It just wiped it out. It blew it apart. It exploded it away. No way to escape. Those neighbors, within 2.5 hours, had commandeered a piece of excavating equipment, had routed a culvert that had been swept down, put it at the right angle, and started filling in rock and dirt so that they could get out of McRoberts and escape and get equipment into McRoberts to help with the cleanup. I was there, gosh, 10 days or more after the deluge, and I remember coming up to that, looking down, seeing that there was this crossing down at the bottom of the creek, nosing my car in, crossing it, coming out the other end, and just wondering at the strength of the people who, in the rain, in the devastation, in the tragedy, could pull that feat together.
It's a wonderful reminder of the fact that we're talking about a can-do spirit, and not only that, in situations like this, a will-do spirit. Reggie Van Stockham, thank you so much for your recollections here, and we look forward to more in the future.
Thank you, Tom.
Kentucky was once one of the largest sheep-producing states in the country, and farmers in southeastern Kentucky have been uniting behind a renaissance for the sheep and wool industry as a contribution to the economic revitalization of the region. And then came the flood of late July. With us is Patrick Angel, founder of the Southeast Kentucky Sheep Producers Association. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you, Tom. It's an honor to be with you again.
Well, I appreciate it. And if you would, let's just jump right into what happened to your members as a result of that flood.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I know that everyone's hearts are going out to those families who lost loved ones and or their homes from the flood in eastern Kentucky. The flood impacted everyone in the mountains, directly or indirectly. And so, as you might imagine, farm families are also suffering. Barns have been swept away. Hay has been ruined. Pastures covered with mud. Fencing has been destroyed. And sheep and goats and guard animals have been drowned and lost, as well as cattle and horses. There's livestock wandering through the mountains, lost and in need of safe barns and secure pastures as soon as possible. There are farm animals that are starving, and you know the need is immediate and urgent. So let me just tell a couple quick stories. Just imagine suddenly being faced with the choice of either having to save your livestock or saving your neighbor's family. One farm family up in Breathitt County lost their entire herd of goats in the flood. The farmer was away from his home trying to help his neighbors move out of the rising floodwaters, you know, as quick as possible when it happened. Otherwise, he probably could have gotten his livestock to higher ground. His barn was destroyed. All the fencing was torn out and the pastures were covered with thick, a thick layer of mud. Another farmer up in Perry County, for example, you know, floodwaters swept over his farm so fast that the family lost their two large guard dogs and half of the flock of sheep. hearing of that, a farmer way down in Tennessee donated and delivered a guard dog to provide protection for the family's livestock that survived the flood. So sheep and goat production in eastern Kentucky has been on the rise, but the recent flood has created major setbacks for the mountain people.
What can people do?
People can go to the website for the two sheep associations in the state of Kentucky, the Southeast Kentucky Sheep Producers Association or the Kentucky Sheep and Goat Development Office, and click on the GoFundMe button. That's sexpa.com or kysheepandgoat.org, and then click on the GoFundMe button.
That's being overseen by your board members, is that correct?
That is correct, yes, and working in partnership with the Kentucky Sheep and Goat Development Office. If you want details of how we're helping farm families in the mountains, or if you want to donate material, just call me, Patrick Angel, at 606-312-5264.
Patrick Angel, founder of the Southeast Kentucky Sheep Producers Association. We thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, the consequences of PFAS or forever chemicals in our environment.
He had to slaughter most of his dairy cows. It totally ruined his business.
And new books from Sally Bingham and Ellen Burkett Morris. You'll hear from both. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supporting veterans through an honor flight to Washington, D.C. The public is invited to the Welcome Home Celebration on September 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Bluegrass Airport. More at honorflightky.org. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker. Provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What do you know about PFAS, or so-called forever chemicals? This is the family of compounds, including Teflon, found not only in pots and pans, but also in the blood of people around the world, including 99% of Americans. These chemicals find their way into water. They don't break down, and they remain in the environment and in people for decades. PFAS chemicals have been linked to testicular, kidney, liver, and pancreatic cancer, weakened childhood immunity, low birth weight, endocrine disruption, increased cholesterol, and weight gain in children and dieting adults. Molly Frazier was here back in February to talk about a method that she had developed as a result of doctoral research at UK that yielded a method to remove PFAS chemicals from the environment. There have been recent developments, including Molly's hiring by Boeing to work on rocket launch systems. We'll talk to her about that in a moment. But we wanted to talk to Molly before she gets busy in New Orleans and ask her to come back and bring us up to speed on PFAS contamination. Thanks for joining us, Molly.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there was a conference earlier this summer focusing on PFAS chemicals and EPA regulation. And for a science conference, it was uncharacteristically emotional at times. We'll come back around to it in just a moment. But first, talk to us about action taken by the EPA, followed by an industry reaction that in the end means these chemicals remain in circulation. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. The EPA had set limits on two of these chemicals. Keep in mind, there are tens of thousands. Two of these chemicals, the most ubiquitous, and they had set in 2016 the limits as 70 part per trillion. But in June, they had updated those health advisory levels to much lower limits. And part of that is due to these human epidemiology studies on populations that have been exposed to PFAS. The updated health advisories are now much, much lower, as low as 0.004 part per trillion. And what ultimately formed the basis for these low limits is the fact that they were seeing suppression of vaccine response in children. So that was a pretty serious response that they saw and caused action by the EPA in June.
And then following that action, the industry did something to make it possible to continue to manufacture these chemicals. Is that correct?
Yes. So this is a common tactic used by manufacturers or industries, especially in like pharmaceuticals or chemical production industries. And it really highlights the problem that we have in regulation of just one chemical at a time instead of classes of chemicals at a time. So when we regulate one chemical or one compound, all they have to do is, you know, slightly change the formulation or the structure of that. And then now they have a new, less regulated chemical that they can use as a substitution. So you can imagine the issue that might come with that, because now we have a mixture of all of these different compounds in the environment instead of just a few that they were dealing with.
Well, back to that PFAS conference in June that I mentioned, what you've described to me and what I've seen on videos from the conference certainly is not your typical dry agenda of science speak, if you will. There was a lot of emotion. People like Emily Marpy, mother of three and class representative for a class action lawsuit against Petersburg, New York, which settled for $23.5 million.
What really lit a fire in me was the town supervisor telling me, you know, you're going to cost 200 people their jobs. You know, and I just kind of whipped around and said, you want to kill my two kids? Like, bring it. Yeah. That day forward, I was at every meeting. I went everywhere. I met people. I did everything I could to educate myself. I felt like I was a toxicologist, an epidemiologist. I mean, I'm tired.
And Molly, Emily Marpy talked about the results of blood tests and her infant daughter and her.
She was tested at 7 weeks old, and I was tested on the same day as well. And she tested at 79.6 parts per billion. That is 7 weeks after being born. That is not drinking the water. That's almost 2.5 years of me not drinking the water.
So 79.6 parts per billion in a 7-week-old. If you could put that in perspective for us, Molly, what does that mean?
79.6 part per billion. The health advisories set by the EPA currently are on a scale of part per trillion. So this is a million times over what researchers have determined is a safe limit to be exposed to. And this is a 7-week-old that we're talking to. And as she mentioned in that clip, her daughter had not been drinking the water. She was not exposed through breast milk because Emily decided not to breastfeed during that time with her new infant. This was just simply what she was exposed to by her mother in the womb.
Now, the conference also heard from a dairy farmer from Maine, Fred Stone. What was his story?
Another devastating one, unfortunately. Fred is a dairy farmer, and they unfortunately found very high levels of toxic PFOS in the sludge that was spread across his farmland, which his dairy cows were exposed to. It totally infiltrated the cow milk. He had to slaughter most of his dairy cows. It totally ruined his business. He was in significant debt, and that's not even talking about, you know, the health consequences that he and his wife also faced. So again, at this conference, you're just hearing story after story of these community members that are so devastatingly impacted by PFAS contamination.
Well, are there certain areas of the country where PFAS and PFOS exposure is especially high, or is it just everywhere?
So it has been reported that there are much higher levels around certain areas that are high risk. So that would be around military bases. So if you've lived in, on, or near military base, or you currently do, there are also high risk areas around manufacturing sites where these chemicals have been produced. And then, you know, this toxic waste has just been released into the river. So If you're thinking about those communities that live along, you know, the Ohio River in northern Kentucky, that's your main water source, right? So there could be a high risk of exposure if that is your public water system gets water from, you know, a major river. But yeah, there's a high risk if you're near some of these military bases or airports even, because they do a lot of training with firefighting foam and different things on those sites.
And what about the people that work with those things? Occupational exposure. What occupations are at high risk?
Obviously, our service members are at high risk because of all the training that they do. Firefighters, next, I would say. There were a few that spoke at the PFAS conference with some, you know, pretty devastating statistics. If you install carpet, it's considered a high exposure occupation. Those would be a few. So basically veterans, the military, firefighters, things like that.
Mm-hmm. When we talked to you back in February, it was about the PFAS removal method that you had developed. Can you remind our listeners about that just briefly?
So I had been working for years on developing materials to help remove PFAS from water. Hopefully, you know, ones that can be reused over and over. So these would be something that could be employed at like a public water system or even on site for particularly challenging environmental issues. So basically the water would come into contact with these materials and they would pull the PFAS out of the water. And then you would have a clean water stream. Now, of course, that just means that now you have to do something with the PFAS that you've captured, because as we know through research, these do not break down or go away. You basically then would have to figure out a way to store them as toxic waste.
Molly, you provided us with information on water filters, and we posted that to our homepage along with this interview. And you can find that at esweku.org. After pouring through that information, what was your conclusion?
My conclusion based on that publication is that there are multiple different water filters that you can look at. But depending on what your budget is, you can make the right decision for your house. But for me particularly, I decided to go with the carbon block filter underneath my kitchen sink. So that's a two-stage filtration system with a carbon block. I also have a point of use filter. So that's like a Brita pitcher, or you can have those ones that attach directly to your faucet. The research basically focuses on two different types, whether it's your point of entry, like a whole house filter or something, you know, like that, or a point of use, which would be, you know, if you get water out of your refrigerator and you replace that carbon filter. I think the most important thing, the most important takeaway is that you need to be changing your filter often, and you need to be checking that, because if you have a filter and you're not changing it regularly, then it really does you no good.
Right. Well, again, that's a really comprehensive piece of information that you provided for us, so I urge everybody to take a look at it. And before you go, Molly, I want to congratulate you on that new job. You're going to be working on rocket launch systems at Boeing, so now we can actually say we know a rocket scientist. Is that right?
Yes, I guess that's right. Thank you.
Well, that's incredible, and we're very proud of you. Dr. Molly Fraser, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and take care, everyone.
Cynthia Reeser returns in her new role as General Assignment Interviewer here on Eastern Standard, and with a person whose name is familiar to many Kentuckians.
Author and native Kentuckian Sally Bingham is joining me here today. She's published 15 books, numerous short stories, and has been awarded prizes and fellowships for her writing. She was the publisher of The American Voice in the 1990s and the book editor for the Courier Journal newspaper in the 80s. She's also the founder of the Kentucky Foundation for Women and the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History at Duke University. Her newest book, Little Brother, A Memoir, is about the life and the very tragic death of her younger brother, Jonathan Worth Bingham, who died in 1964 at age 21. Sally, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
First, tell us, why did you choose to write this memoir about your younger brother, Jonathan?
I've been thinking about him and what happened to him for now, 50 years. And it's always been clear to me that I needed to write about it when I felt I was ready. My purpose in writing this story is to do what I can to prevent the repetition of this pattern. We lose too many young people. I've always focused on young women, but we lose more young men to these combined causes of drug use, alcoholism, depression. And I want to see if I can have any effect on the future in terms of perhaps losing fewer young men for these reasons.
And the story of your brother's brief life is also the story of growing up in a privileged family. For listeners who might not recognize your name, your father, Barry Bingham Sr., inherited Louisville's Courier Journal newspaper, and of course he went on to control a media empire of radio and television stations. And your father and your mother, Mary Caperton Bingham, were active in the state and national Democratic politics for decades. I know when I read your book, I was sort of starstruck by the circles that they moved in. And of course, their expectations were very high for their children. And many assume that rich and powerful people have perfect lives. But I think the story you tell about your brother in your memoir, and also the story of the other siblings that you refer to, helps to uncover some of the problems of inherited wealth.
Yes. You know, we tend to be too enamored of money and power. I think that's true all through society. And it's very important to remember that anything that has to do with money and power is going to be to some degree poisoned, and particularly when it's inherited, because nobody has life handed to them on a silver platter. And it sometimes happens that inheritors think that life is going to be easier because of the amount of money they've inherited and the social position they have inherited. And it never turns out that way. Everything depends on our own personal endeavor. And that's why the glamorization of these lives, I think, is so dangerous. It's not really the pattern that I want to see people in this culture emulate.
Could you read us a passage from your book to help illustrate a little bit more what it's about?
Yes, I'm going to read a brief passage from the very beginning, actually begin with a prologue that lists all the many people in my birth family who have died untimely, either by accidents or suicide or overdose. And then I go into chapter one to describe Jonathan. A little boy with frail blonde hair, not curly, but wavy, almost to his shoulders, not yet cut short. A little boy in short pants, shirt untucked, shoelaces dangling, as he sits in the back seat of the family station wagon, staring out the window. The station wagon, driven by our mother, is gliding down the twisting road that leads to Frankfort, the Kentucky state capital. A steep limestone bluff falls to the river. At a break in the bluff, a scenic overlook, our mother pulls off the road. Our two older brothers reach for the door, but there is no time to get out. The stop will be brief. In the back seat, I am watching my little brother, Jonathan. He is staring at the dome of the state capitol below the bluff. The dome flashes in the afternoon sun. 215 feet high, it is the tallest building Jonathan has ever seen. Stately paired Ionic columns support the dome above the square mast of the Capitol building itself. Our mother explains that they are Corinthian columns, identified by their crowns of carved leaves and flowers. A classic scholar in college, she knows her columns. The little boy doesn't seem to hear. He is staring at the gilded dome. If that isn't beautiful, nothing is, he says.
You relate many of your brother's challenges to the very, what would be considered today, restrictive norms of the 50s and 60s. And you discuss, you know, specific roles for men, for women, how sexual activity between young people was often looked down on or to be avoided. And people also avoided any kind of topics related to mental illness or learning challenges. And some people today might say, oh, that's no longer relevant. We fixed those problems. But do you think society has changed so that young men and women can really avoid those pressures?
Well, you know, we certainly haven't fixed these problems. In fact, we have more people diagnosed with mental illness today than we ever have in the past. We don't know how to treat it. We've tried many things. Most of them haven't worked. In terms of the treatment of men and women, that has changed. I've seen that in my lifetime. I was part of the second wave of feminism that started in the 1970s, and we were very much involved in passing Roe v. Wade back then and felt that that would be the law of the land forever. Unfortunately, we've learned the reverse. So in that way, things have changed, and I think considerably for the better. But in terms of talking about or treating any form of mental illness, we're still stuck. People don't talk about it. There's too much shame involved. Families feel too responsible for what happens. We don't know the causes. We have no idea what to do about it. So it continues to be an ongoing misfortune that disfigures the lives of many people in our culture today.
It's a little unrelated to this, your particular book, but you allude to how you and your sister were treated very differently as well. So talk a little bit about your recent work as a feminist.
Well, here in Santa Fe, fortunately, I find a lot of people who share my political views as a feminist, and we are now actively engaging in making sure that choice remains legal and viable in this state. That, for me right now, is the issue I'm most concerned with. We also have a really amazing slate of women running for both the state legislature and the national. But my writing remains my main purpose, and I've just embarked on a new memoir about my son called The Eyes of Addicts. And I'm right in the midst of editing what I hope will be the final draft of that.
And I look forward to reading that. It sounds like it will be very powerful, especially after reading about the death of your younger brother.
Yes.
And of course, the death of your son was much more recent in 2017.
Right.
Thank you for joining us today. And Sally's book is available at local bookstores and also online in its Little Brother, a Memoir, published by Sarah Band Books, which is a literary press in Louisville, Kentucky. And you can learn more about her on her website, sallybingham.com. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for hosting me, Cynthia and Tom. I really enjoyed it.
And this is Cynthia Reeser for Eastern Standard.
Tom Eblin hosts our series on Kentucky authors and poets, and Tom is back with an author said to possess an impressive ability to hide devastating truths within seemingly small moments.
Ellen Burkett Morris is an award-winning short story writer and a poet from Louisville. She has been publishing stories for years in literary journals, and they finally have been published to a wider audience in her new debut collection, Lost Girls. With inside humor and a lot of gritty realism, Morris's stories explore the lives, relationships, and insecurities of girls and women. Her stories are tightly written and driven by memorable characters. Ellen Burkett Morris is here with us today to talk about her collection, Lost Girls. Ellen, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, tell us about this collection of stories and the themes that run through it.
Yeah. You know, I think all writers find as they're working that they've got certain ground that they work. And for me, it was always questions of seeing and being seen. It was questions of respect and self-reliance and those kinds of things. And so what I began to do was write some short stories about women and girls set in a fictional Eastern Kentucky town. And what I found is that there was a thread that ran through all of those stories, and that thread was, in fact, those themes that I just talked about. And that as I was imagining the lives of these women and girls, they were in situations that would sort of call upon them to find strength in themselves and find strength from the women around them.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite story in the book?
Oh, gosh. My favorite story would have to be religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is the story of a very lonely woman who accidentally wanders into a breastfeeders league meeting, and because they're so warm and lovely, finds that she doesn't want to leave. And so she comes back and she creates a fake identity, and she tries to find a way to connect with that part of herself that's not been nurtured by attempting to breastfeed. And so it's a really strange story. It's funny. It's sad. It's definitely the one that's closest to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you hope the readers take away from these stories?
Well, you know, I'm, as an avid reader myself, I always look to be entertained, to be transported, occasionally to learn something about myself or about the world. And so I'd wish that for my readers as well. I'm hoping that they find themselves or other women that they know in the stories. I've had women come up to me after reading the book and say, I have a lost girl story for you, and usually it's something from their personal experience. So I find that very gratifying. And that the men who read the stories may find themselves with a little more insight into the lives and challenges and triumphs of women.
Well, now your background, I guess, is in journalism and communications. What motivates you to be a fiction writer?
Well, I have to say, you know, I loved journalism, but I found that it, for me, it was always a way to write. It was a way to do that storytelling, and that, you know, ultimately that canvas wasn't big enough for me, that I wanted to kind of see where I could take it. My father was a writer. He published a couple of Private Eye novels that were set in and around Louisville and Lexington that were published in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I have to say that, you know, I had a role model for that.
Mm. What was his name?
John Burkett.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And he wrote The Queen's Mare and The Last Private Eye, and I got a chance to watch him work and also got a great sense of story from him because he would read to us all the time and take us to the library. So that was part of it, too. I knew that it could be done because I had seen it done. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read, and I guess it was in your introduction, you mentioned some of the bedtime stories he read to you as a child, which were, let's say, a little unusual.
Yeah. He was somebody who was really interested in what he was interested in. And so whether it was reading Flannery O'Connor short stories to us as bedtime stories, which he did, or taking us to completely inappropriate movies, which he also did, you know, that was part of it. But, you know, I have to say, as horrifying as some of those O'Connor stories were, I do feel like a sense of language, a sense of drama, a sense of story seeped into me from having heard those and mm-hmm. processed those at an early age.
Yeah, I would, as a child, I would think that some of those would be a little hard to get to sleep after.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned that, and that's one thing I liked about your writing. It's very tight. You know, it reminds me of O'Connor and other writers. What other writers have influenced you?
Oh, gosh. You know, I have to say, fabulous Kentucky-based female writers like Bobby Ann Mason, to pick up her stories and to see what she was able to do and to know that she was also from Kentucky was really fantastic for me, really, really heartening, and let me know that, you know, this is something that could be done. Barbara Kingsolver's short stories, were so fantastic and held worlds within them, you know, and so that was something that I wanted to emulate. And so they were very instrumental in my development as a writer. Also, I'd have to say Elizabeth Strout, who wrote Olive Kittredge, to see what she was able to achieve there through linked short stories was very, very encouraging. And I really found that her work, well, I mean, it won the Pulitzer, so anyway, so fantastic. And just another example of the kind of writing that was out there by women. And another thing to give me courage as I stepped forward and began to work on that sort of stuff myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you've taught writing also, and I'm curious what you would say in your stories that people who are interested in writing or want to become better writers, what could they learn from the style and approach and kind of the way you work stories? You know, for instance, do a lot of revisions, a lot of rewriting.
I guess the first thing that I would tell them is that story lies in detail, and that as they are building a world and building characters, if they can attach themselves to some unique detail and populate the character's world with things that are very much of interest to that character, they will have a place to hang their hat as they go on and develop the story further. They'll have images to return to later that will gain metaphoric weight as the writing continues. So that would be one thing that I would say. You know, the other thing, I'd say get a great writer's group. I've got several, and having other people's eyes on your work is amazing, because then you get a sense of what you thought you put on the page but you didn't. Connections that you think you're making that you may not in fact be making on the page, or areas for expansion, or things that are confusing, or those sorts of things. So it's really great to have somebody to bounce your work off. And then revision is also essential to it. And I guess the other thing is patience. Stories take their own time, mm-hmm. and they're going to take as long as they take. And so you need to be able to sit with that and let it develop and go back and look at it and think about ways to make it better. And, you know, there hasn't been a time ever when I've returned to the page to do revision and not found a way to somehow make it richer, deeper, better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good advice. I know Bobby Ann's told me before that she rewrites things until she can't think of anything else to do with them, and it really shows in her writing.
Yeah.
Well, what are you working on now?
Oh, right now I am in the process of novel revision. I have one novel that I just finished revising with the help of a developmental editor that I am sending around to agents. That is a story called Beware the Tall Grass. That's a novel told in alternate voices between a mother of a child who has past life memories and the soldier whose memories the child has. And the kind of parallel lines that run through each of those stories. So part of it is modern day Washington, D.C. The other part is set in Montana and in Vietnam.
Once again, the book is Lost Girls, a collection of short stories by Ellen Burkett Morris. Thanks for being with us today, Ellen.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, check out our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.